So good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks.
I'm here. I'm not used to people actually responding when I say good afternoon.
Were you saying good afternoon to the audience?
I was saying good. It's like listeners. Friends, Romans, countrymen.
I became your audience.
You did. I was looking at you when I said it.
Yeah, I was confused. Is he saying good afternoon to me or to the audience? And if I am on the podcast, but I listen to the podcast, am I also... Yeah. The audience as well as the featured voice? I don't know.
I've got to work out a way of saying it so that the person who's sitting there realises that I'm speaking to the ether and not to them.
Maybe it could have been, good afternoon, read me something you love, audience.
Uh-huh, okay.
Maybe, I don't know. That sounds a bit unwieldy.
Read me something you lovers.
Read me something you lovers. Yes.
Yeah, maybe not. Anyway, I'm here with Nikesh Shukla, if you hadn't realised that already from his inimitable tones, inimitable verve, brio. And we're sitting in Book House in Clapham, and it's quite exciting, actually, walking towards a house actually made out of books, and B, it says Book House. And you work in Book House.
I work in Book House. It is a house made of books. We're sitting in a room of books. Yeah. I can see a Toni Morrison book, a Jhumpa Lahiri book. Lots of books. More books than just those two, though. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yesterday I was on the internet and there was a thing going around, an artist who's made a bathtub out of books. And like, should she do it? Shouldn't she do it? But literally out of books, and then she covers it with resin. But this is a whole house made of books.
This is the house of books.
Yes. And Nikesh, if you don't know him, first of all, shame on you. If you do know him, you will know him possibly as a...
Shame on him.
As a poet, performer, MC, ladies' man.
Happily married man.
Oh, yes, God, sorry, you just told me that for 10 minutes ago. Yes, I'm only saying that because it's Valentine's Day and I'm kind of in that kind of silly mood.
I feel bad still having poet and MC on my CV, as they're things that I haven't done for a very long time.
Yeah.
And things that as soon as I got a book signed and realised that that was perhaps where I was slightly better than the other things, I stopped doing the other things.
Mm. Well, hopefully today is the opportunity for you to bring together all of those bows in your quiver? Is that the word?
Yes. Yeah. Arrows in your quiver.
Arrows in your quiver.
Oh, we want to have more than one bow
in
your quiver.
All those arrows.
You won't be able to fit any arrows.
All those arrows in your quiver. I'll edit that one out. And you're going to be reading for us some Dave Eggers.
Yes, I'm a big, big Dave Eggers fan. It almost seems like it's uncool to say that you like Dave Eggers now, because people seem to have some weird reaction to him, like, oh, you're such a hipster, you like Dave Eggers. Yeah, I like Dave Eggers, he's a funny man. And he's a funny man who writes in a very relatable tone to my brain box, I guess. That wasn't very, very well thought out metaphor.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a fan as well, and maybe we'll talk a little bit later about our fandom. But shall we go straight into the story?
Sure, yes. This is from a collection of short stories that he wrote, or very short stories that he published on The Guardian, and then I think Penguin put out a little book of them. This one is the only short story in the history of every short story ever written to make both me and my dad laugh. My dad isn't much of a reader, but this story, I left the book in the bathroom once when I was living at home, and he read it and he said it was the funniest thing he'd ever read. It's not the funniest thing I've ever read, but it does make me laugh, and I think it's notable for having made me and my dad laugh. So yeah, it's called You Know How to Spell Elijah. You're at the airport, airless, sitting in a black faux leather chair near your departure gate. There is a girl, about 12, sitting in a similar chair across the wide, immaculate aisle, and she wants to know how to spell Elijah. She is working on a crossword in Teen Magazine and is squinting at it, chewing her inner mouth. She's flanked by her parents and soon appeals to them for help. Her father is burly and bearded, her mother tall and thin. Her mother, who reminds you of a praying mantis, answers her daughter's question this way. It's easy, Dakota. E-L-I-S-H-A. I know you have your own things to do, your own boating week to read and your bagel to eat. You can no longer concentrate on anything but this girl's crossword puzzle, quickly being polluted by the advice of the people she calls her parents. And the young girl is working not in pencil, fool, but in pen. You're burning to tell her the truth about the young actor's name spelling, but fear you would embarrass or undermine her mother, which you don't want to do. Besides, you think, the girl's father will surely correct the mother. Isn't that the beauty of the two-parent system? Indeed it is, for here he is now, leaning over, inspecting the crossword, and now he's putting on his glasses, even. And finally he says, no, Sharon, I'm pretty sure it's A-L-I-G-A. Fucking Christ! You let out a quick, desperate cough. These people cannot be serious. This poor girl, stuck forever in a dill... This poor girl, stuck forever in a dim, ill-spelling world, nowhere to turn. She'll never know the spelling of Elijah, or Enrique, or even Justin, or JC. Shouldn't you intervene? Isn't it your duty? Don't those who know the truth have a responsibility to stop the dissemination of untruths? You must step in. You can do so good-naturedly. You can do so without upsetting the family unit, the sanctity thereof. But you're 18 foot away, making it impossible without implying that you are paying far more attention to the girl's crossword than would seem casual or proper. They'll assume you have an unhealthy interest in Teen Magazine and its cover boys. And really now, what were you doing, listening in to her spelling request? Isn't your own life complicated enough? Is your own existence so free of mistakes that you need to seek them out in strangers, inserting yourself into the life of a 12-year-old girl with a crush on a Hobbit-playing actor? No wonder you're on your way to a spa in the Palm Desert. You damn well need the rest.
Fabulous, thank you. So I think you got it spot on when you said, when you kind of were talking about just what you like about Eggers and his writing, that relatable feeling. It's very much in the voice and the tone, isn't it?
Yeah, he isn't flowery, and he doesn't dress anything up in ridiculously complicated metaphors, and he doesn't do that traditional American thing of very clipped sentences. It's very conversational. It's very man in a room telling anecdote. These short stories are particularly good for that feeling of someone just telling you a thing that happened. And it's interesting to think that he's only ever written one book of fiction, but the rest of it is non-fiction, and it's very hard to make non-fiction, especially given the type of stuff he's written about, which is very, very depressing, whether it being about his own life or the lives of others, to make it very relatable and engaging and entertaining and sad and funny and all the rest of it. And just his strength is just to really nail the gamut of human emotion. He can talk about the tragic and the hilarious in the same sentence, and you're with him because his style isn't complicated that it excludes the reader.
Mm. And yet he does have, it's not, I mean, because you said it's sort of a man telling a story in a room, but there is a lot more to that though, isn't it? I mean, he does have a real relish for language.
Yeah.
And wordplay, you know, sort of there's little things that sort of jump out, you know, the girl's crossword puzzle, you know, quickly being polluted. I love that way he uses the word polluted. Polluted by the advice of these people she calls her parents, and lots of that kind of stuff going on.
I also love the sort of the rope. I don't know if it's the old switcheroo ending, but that I think the last line of it really nails it for me, because at first you just assume it's a guy who doesn't suffer fools gladly. And we can all relate to that, you know, whenever someone sends you an email and they're confused there and there, or gets, you know, the exact location of Carlisle wrong or something, it will set off that pedant, that annoyed pedant.
The inner Larry David.
Yeah, and I think for the longest time you think that that's what this story is about, is this guy is overhearing a conversation and he's getting annoyed because the parents are idiots and the girl is going to grow up in the company of these idiots. But actually then the old switcheroo happens and you find out that actually this is a man who really needs to relax because he's about to explode. And it's amazing that all that is conveyed in under 500 words. Yeah.
But it's a good-natured annoyance, and that's also something that I love about Eggers. There's that kind of good-naturedness. There's a real it's a kind of a freewheeling. You know, it's never mean-spirited
because his flair for language is a lot more subtle than you'd expect, and he knows how to pepper humour throughout all the horrific things that happen to people. It's just very engaging. I love him. I think he is one of my favourite writers.
Mm. So you've got a man sitting in an airport, ostensibly. I mean, he's people watching. Is that something you do quite a bit of? All writers surely have to be quite keen.
I love eavesdropping on conversations.
Eavesdropping and
you know that. I guess that's what Twitter is so great for, because it's become the non-obvious notepad of misheard and out of context snippets of conversation that you hear.
Mm.
For example, I was in the pub on Saturday night, and I was, whenever my friend went to the bar or to the toilet, I was listening in on this conversation happening at the table next to us, and one girl was telling another girl about how she thought she was a great dancer despite what anyone thought, and so what if she danced it as a matter of urgency that made the dance more appealing. And it was brilliant. She just had this complete self-belief that she looked amazing when she was dancing, but everyone else thought that she looked really stressful and she wanted to know what their problem was with it was. And yeah, Twitter was basically my conduit for relating that to the world. And maybe I'll use it somewhere. You know, it's been documented now and might figure in something I write later on, and I guess this short story kind of plays into that. You know, if this guy reading his Boating Week had a smartphone and access to a Twitter account, maybe his anger would have been assuaged by being able to tweet it. Might have helped diffuse the misdirected anger in him.
But then he might not have written the story, and that's perhaps the problem with Twitter, is that, you know, I've only been doing it for a few months, but I already see that I've got, you know, I've written about 450 tweets. And I think I could have written 450 real sentences, you know, sort of sentences that might actually add up to something. I've got 450 tweets.
That is true, but I do find it a good dumping ground for ideas. And especially when you're on the fly and something occurs to you and you may not have pen and paper to hand. If you put it on Twitter, like, often I've seen or heard something, tweeted about it, and then looked back at the tweet and thought, oh, I didn't phrase that right. Ah, I know how to phrase it right. And it then becomes a joke that then you can reuse, or a piece of observational humour that you can reuse.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I read Dave Eggers, I don't know how it is for you, but for me, and maybe it's because my first access to him was obviously through heartbreaking work of Staggering Genius, which is just a heartbreaking work. I mean, the title itself. Wouldn't you have loved to have called your first novel?
It's brilliant.
A heartbreaking work of Staggering Genius.
How do you blur that book?
Well, it does what it says in, you know, it says on the tin, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's the Ronson of novel of memoirs, I guess.
Yeah, it is amazing
book.
But I think because that was his first work I've read, and perhaps that's still my favourite, everything I read of his, including this, I just assume that the character is Dave Eggers.
Yeah.
It's always, for me, Dave Eggers. And I don't know how he would feel about that. But to a certain extent also, I suppose I'm asking you that because I sort of do the same thing with your stuff as well, to some extent. And I'm just wondering how that feels for you to think that at some level a reader is reading something and thinking, no, this is really coming kind of from Nikesh here. It's coming from the heart. I mean, it's intimately connected to him.
Yes. I mean, it's an interesting conversation I have with some of my writer friends that what I do tends to come from certain things within my life. And there are writers who write a bit of themselves each time, and there are writers who write because they want to explore something they've never considered before. And I guess I'm the former. I think a lot of my work in the last year and a half has been informed by the fact that my mum died the week my novel came out. And so every time I sat down to write after Coconut Limited, which was kind of a snapshot of where I grew up, everything I sat down to write after that was informed by this tragedy that I didn't, because there was so much going on in my life, I didn't really have any other outlet for dealing with it. And so that's why it all, or everything that I tend to write down at the moment seems to come from a place within me, because, yeah, there's just a lot to get out of writing. And
I mean, it's interesting you say that, because that's obviously how I actually found out first about you, through that story which was read on Radio 4.
Mm.
And I didn't know that that was actually based on fact.
I was trying to work out a non-trite way of writing about social media. I mean, how do you write about social media when, A, it's changing all the time, and B, even though you're engaged with the jargon, you still cringe when you think about the types of conversations or emails you're having where you're talking about liking comments and did you see that retweet from that guy? And so the best way to approach it was to talk about when I had to, well, to fictionalise the morning I spent trying to take down my mum's Facebook account because people were leaving lots of messages on it. And that story was, it was very, very close to the bone for a lot of people, but I'm glad I wrote it, because it was good to write a serious piece of writing, and it was very cathartic as well. I'm so glad that they allowed me to read it as well, because it was written in my voice, and being someone who's not averse to getting up on stage and making a twat of himself for purposes of attention seeking, I enjoyed being able to put that on the radio.
I mean, I'm aware, obviously, with us speaking just today, how we started very light-hearted, and this is ostensibly a light-hearted, it's a fun story. And we've gone to quite a sad place. I mean, I'm feeling quite sad. But I suppose in a way that this story also speaks to that. It speaks to how to contain that sadness. Because there is a sadness here, isn't there? That sense of, maybe a child who, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but maybe a child who's interested in crosswords and interested in literature and has parents who are maybe not particularly supportive or who are not on her kind of level or whatever. I mean, am I reading too much into this?
I have a different reading of it. I feel like it is a parable for the passive-aggressive in all of us, in that there are moments in our lives where we'll want to intervene in something because we've heard something so ridiculous, and we won't because we understand the basic rules of social etiquette. But it'll get us so riled up and angry, and that anger is so misdirected, and obviously it's coming from another place. That anger is just channeled outwards from something else that's going on in your life. And so I think in a really, really short space of time, Dave Eggers has really nailed the idea of feeling really frazzled and stressed and almost taking it out on a 12-year-old who doesn't know how to spell Elijah Wood's name. This poor girl, stuck forever in a dim, ill-spelling world, nowhere to turn. She'll never know the spelling of Elijah, or Enrique, or even Justin, or JC. Shouldn't you intervene? Isn't it your duty? Don't those who know the truth have a responsibility to stop the dissemination of untruths? You must step in. You can do so good-naturedly. You can do so without upsetting the family unit, the sanctity thereof. But you're 18 foot away, making it impossible without implying that you are paying far more attention to the girl's crossword than would seem casual or proper. They'll assume you have an unhealthy interest in Teen Magazine and its cover boys. And really now, what were you doing, listening in to her spelling request? Isn't your own life complicated enough? Is your own existence so free of mistakes that you need to seek them out in strangers, inserting yourself into the life of a 12-year-old girl with a crush on a Hobbit-playing actor? No wonder you're on your way to a spa in Palm Desert. You damn well need the rest.